Hello, welcome to Strange Love of Movies. My name is Olivia Martinez, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Oscar and Emily Martinez. And today, we are on episode 7 of our Coen Brothers series with the iconic cult classic, The Big Lebowski.
Yes, this is going to be a tough episode because Big Lebowski is one of our very favorite films. I mean, we've seen it countless times, and it's just almost, I mean, there's just so much of it that we've memorized, and it's really kind of hard to judge it for people who haven't seen it.
I mean, we have the poster on our media room wall. Like, this is an intense love the Martinez family has for this film.
Yes, and in the parlance of our times, this is one hilarious film. It's fantastic, and we loved it, Emily and I, when we saw it at the movies. In fact, we were probably one of the few people in the world who saw it twice at the movies, because it wasn't out. Originally, when it came out, it was not that big a hit for a variety of reasons. And it was in 1998, so it's been out for 25 years. Isn't that hard to believe?
It is.
I would have said
it
was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But
yeah, it really developed a cult following after maybe going on, I don't know if it was on cable or DVD or what, but yeah.
There's something so funny about the fact that it was such a bomb. I don't know why. Just because they probably made this movie not thinking it would make any money. Like, I think this was definitely a passion kind of project because it was just so weird and absolutely ridiculous. And then the fact that, just like they imagined, it made no money, but then it comes back for this cult following. And I mean, literally, we went to a Big Lebowski bar in Iceland.
Yes.
Like, this film is worldwide.
Yes, and there's no other film that has a Coen Brothers film that has a festival around it.
That's
festivals
insane.
All around the country where people dress up in bowling shirts. Bowling is a big theme of this film. And they act like the characters. And this is 25 years after the fact. We have nieces and nephews who weren't even born. And you weren't even born when this came out. Who know every other line in the film. It's just incredible. It's a class. It's truly a classic, but it's also a cult classic.
And for people who lived through the 90s, it's especially relevant, I think. But it's just something. It has to do with the characters. They're just hilarious. Completely bizarre, eccentric. Most of us have never met anybody like any of these characters, thank goodness. But they're just so fun to follow in the movie.
In a lot of the film, it seems improvised. But as anybody will ever say, any actor worth their salt will say, we're not good enough to be improvised. But they rehearsed quite a bit, and they were locked into their characters. So anything they said was in the terms of the characters. And the other characters, you want to get to some of the characters, Lynn?
Well, before we do that, I was just going to say one of the reasons why this is the perfect comedy is because all the characters are so unique and that they all take themselves so seriously. None of them are playing it for a joke. They're just playing the character they were given.
Exactly.
Which is why so many comedies fail because, you know, goofy Adam Sandler movies and stuff like that, he's playing it to be funny, blah, blah, blah. But they're playing it to be these people who just happen to be hilarious.
And that's probably why it seems so improvised, because
yes,
they're saying what you know those characters would probably say, as opposed to reading a script with a bad word or two in it or something. It's beyond that. It's a whole other level of character development.
And let's be honest, the plot is ludicrous in this film.
As Maude Lebowski would say.
There are so many different random interwoven stories. None of these characters need to have ever met each other, but it just, whatever. So we should start with the dude who is, his Christian name is Jeff Lebowski. And the film centers on him, who's played by Jeff Bridges. Wow, what a guy.
I know. He really is such a useless human being, and yet lovable in his own way.
Yeah, he's a child of the 60s who's still smoking pot and bowling. That seems to be all he does, right?
And
unemployed.
Just walks around in a like a robe.
Bathrobe and shorts.
He has the worst style I've ever seen. But yeah, so the film centers on him, and there's another Lebowski, the Big Lebowski. That's a funny thing. This movie is not named after the dude. It's named after this old man that the dude is confused with this old man.
Yeah, it starts off with mistaken identity.
And I think this time around, I realized just how funny it was, how many times his house got broken into. That place was a dump from the get-go. But the fact that like three separate occasions, these totally different people break into his house and like just totally assault him is insane.
I know. A man's home is supposed to be his castle. And at one point, he's even in the bathtub and he says, hey, this is a private residence, man.
And they're just breaking stuff. And then we have Walter, who is this Vietnam vet. Based on the guy who, what was it, Dad?
There are a couple of things. One of them is they say he's based off on the real-time director and movie producer John Milius and screenwriter. He wrote a little movie called Apocalypse Now.
Best movie ever.
Very macho, very testosterone-driven, and probably one of the few conservatives in Hollywood. That's why you don't hear from much from him anymore. He doesn't make movies, but he was one inspiration. Then apparently there was another guy on the set of their first film, Blood Simple, who, when they talked to him years later, he said, yeah, I was probably the basis for that because I couldn't start a sentence without using the term, well, back in Vietnam, you know? So and that's what makes it funny too, because these characters, they're based on real people. Like the dude.
Yeah, the dude know, is based on a real person.
Yes. Some of those incidents where at one point the dude's car, that poor car, is stolen. They had a friend whose car was stolen, and they found the kid's homework. The kid who stole it, they found his homework in his car. That actually happened.
So, yeah, Walter, I mean, he's where all the cuss words come from. This movie, it used to hold the record, right?
Yeah, it was at 292 uses of the F word. But
we thought that was a lot.
That since has been surpassed by Wolf of Wall Street and all sorts of other films. Like my mother would say, don't they know another word? But in this movie, it works.
It fits.
It really
does. I mean,
does,
I think that's how these people would talk. Yeah.
And then we have Donnie, who's played by Steve Buscemi. And what's so funny is we talked about Steve Buscemi quite a lot last week with Fargo. And in Fargo, he was just like this evil, not really mastermind because he wasn't very bright, but just like this evil killer. But in this, he's the sweetest guy who just gets ridiculed, like just constantly smacked down by Walter.
And not that bright either.
Yeah, they always tell him to shut up. And he doesn't even say that much, but in the other movie, he wouldn't stop talking. I mean, it's a totally different character, you're right. Polar opposite, but it's so funny.
He does such a good job.
But he's the third in this trio of bowlers who are very tight.
Why are any of them friends? Doesn't make any sense. And so then we have Maude Lebowski, played by Julianne Moore. This is one of her best roles, I think. She's this performance artist, very rich, inherited all her...
Daughter of the Big Lebowski.
Yes, yes. And her introduction's one of the funniest introductions in any film.
And she's terrific, too. I mean, she plays this ridiculous character. He's maybe a blend of Katharine Hepburn and...
Yoko Ono.
Yoko Ono, maybe. Yeah, just really bizarre.
And your theory was kind of that this whole film is making fun of L.A. culture, right?
Yes, I think it probably is, in a kind of a mild sort of way, laughing at a lot of the... kind of wacky people who end up in LA and how many of them are striving to be stars or famous for something, but also just all the people who are around the perimeter of this scene and who have never really kind of grown out of the hippy-dippy era.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's, I mean, the Coen brothers, they came from Minnesota, like we've said in quite a few episodes, so I'm sure they were just so confused when they first got to Hollywood and probably thought it was so ridiculous. So I'm sure that is somewhat of it too.
Yeah, and I think that one example of that is that landlord who invites them to his interpretive dance routine. It's the worst thing you've ever seen, but they go. They go to support him, but they never come back to him at all. But that's an example of everybody's got another artistic. Everyone's an artist at some level, you know.
Exactly.
And what's so good about this movie is that you actually can root for the dude. There are a lot of films, I think actually the Coen brothers, their best films are when you can root for the main character, even though they're goofy. I always go back to Raising Arizona, but you know, Nicolas Cage, he's just so innocent, even though he's ridiculous and technically a jailbird, you know. And in this too, the dude, I mean, he's just so, again, like you said, Mom, useless, but he's nice enough. And
he is, and he certainly doesn't deserve everything that happens to him.
Doesn't deserve any of it.
It's like he's just kind of being blown on the currents of this storm around him, and he does not have the tools to react in the right way. And
yeah, that's
and
the thing.
Survive.
It starts with a case of mistaken identity, and it devolves from there. He's involved in how many plots where how many people, different factions, are going to promise to pay him 20,000, 40,000, 100,000.
And they all promised to kill him, too.
Yeah, that's so funny. And I think that was the origin, as we've discussed in other episodes during this Coen Brothers series. They love film noir, these detective stories. And their idea was, what if we put a totally inept person right in the middle of one of these? And that's what he is. Like, he's no detective. He's no Humphrey Bogart. And yet,
yeah, apparently it was kind of inspired by Raymond Chandler.
Yeah,
which is so funny.
The Big Sleep and movies like that where there's a hard-boiled, you know, there's tough situations, but someone, you know, they always get out of it. And it's ridiculous. We talked about the main characters, but some of the character actors, oh my gosh, John Turturro plays the Jesus.
That is
Jesus Quintana.
Incredible scene.
It is. He's probably on screen at the most, what, 5 minutes total? 7 minutes?
So
he almost stole the movie.
And that had to have been ad-libbed to a large extent.
Yeah, apparently in the I think the DVD, digital video disc, they mentioned that they had seen an improv, and he was playing a variety of characters, John Turturro, and he played a Latino, like a real...
Because the thing is, he's not Hispanic.
Yeah, he's not at all.
Oh, you're right.
He's not at all. And so they thought, that'd be good to have him in a movie where he played that role, and he just took it from there.
And then make him a child pedophile, too.
And then what's almost equally hilarious is his bowling partner, Liam. How do they go together?
He's like the most normal white guy you've ever seen.
Also, bowling is just a hilarious thing to have at the center of your movie. They're in that bowling alley more than they're anywhere else. And it also looks really good. The movie is shot very, very well. I mean, Roger Deakins, of course, but I don't know, the vibrant colors and all of that.
Well, and I think the, just to go back to, you were talking about the memorable characters. I think John Goodman's character, Walter, is kind of, he's unmatched. I mean, he is so over the top. And talk about, he takes himself so seriously.
Yes.
And yet he has this weird obsession with his ex-wife. He's carrying this little dog around for a lot of the movie.
He practices Shabbat, even though he's, what, Polish
Jewish.
Catholic or whatever. Yeah.
It's really funny.
Yeah, and he gets so angry.
And he's the reason they get into a lot of these messes.
And all his instincts are wrong. We talked about...
But they're not at the end.
Well, they're not. Actually, we talked about Fargo, how her instincts were always right. The Frances McDormand, a police chief of that town who solves those murders and solves this terrible string of crime. In his case, he's almost always wrong, and it leads them into war. It just gets worse, you know.
You're right. I feel like his instincts on the battlefield are wrong, but what he thinks is right. Like, he believes that it's a con job.
Yeah.
And he says all these things, but you're right. When they're actually put into action, it does not go well. One of the funniest parts that we laughed at the most this time was when he had that gun and it ended up shooting that their car.
Yeah, the Uzi.
The Uzi.
The amateur.
He called them
the
amateurs. And they're dressed in black leather riding these motorcycles like professional motorcycle drivers, and he's still a bunch of amateurs, you know.
Oh, and also somebody else who deserves mention, actually, there's so many, but Philip Seymour Hoffman as the assistant to the Big Lebowski is... I mean, you've seen people like that. You actually have met somebody like that who is just such a, I don't know, they just are so awed by power and money, and he can't say enough to prop up the Big Lebowski and make him sound a lot better than he really is, because he's kind of a jerk.
Well, in a lot of ways, too, the what you just mentioned about Walter, the John Goodman character, didn't that remind you of today? But I mean, people are that angry. I mean, you think it's a caricature, but they get so mad. And how do you sustain that anger?
Amazing.
It's just amazing. It kind of did touch on, you know, that kind of...
Sort of an underlying...
He believes what he believes, and no one's going to convince him otherwise.
And I think the first 25 minutes of this movie are basically perfect, because every scene is just so memorable. But I do think that introduction to Philip Seymour Hoffman, who introduces the Big Lebowski to the dude, is just, and then the dude and the Big Lebowski's meeting is just basically perfect.
That's so
that actor's name is David Huddleston. He is hilarious because he's this self-made man without the use of his legs, as he keeps reminding people, because he's in a wheelchair and he lost them in Korea. But that didn't stop him. And meanwhile,
to encounter anybody in the world, to have to deal with the dude. I mean, they're polar opposites. He's so impatient with them.
And it doesn't make any sense why he would accept that meeting, or why the dude is even allowed in his house. That just doesn't make sense. It's just like, the whole reason the dude is there is to just get another rug. All he wants is a rug, because he says his rug tied the room together, and basically the man who mistake him for the Big Lebowski peed on his rug.
And we, you know, there's so many favorite scenes, but that's probably my favorite, where the David Huddleston, the Big Lebowski, is yelling after him, "The bum's lost, Mr. Lebowski. Your revolution is over." Like, he's so angry too.
And that's probably pretty current too, because I mean, there is that side that just sees the, I guess, the left wing or whatever. And I mean, the left wing and the right wing are so far apart at this point. And you kind of see that in the Big Lebowski in a funny way.
Well, and he's so funny too, that Jeff Bridges, I mean, he won an Oscar for, was it called Crazy Heart or Wild at Heart? Something like that, Crazy Heart. That was a makeup for this one. I don't even know if he was nominated. He should have been, because it was great. Walter was great. John Goodman was great. It's just amazing because he inhabited that character. And one of the, if you watch it closely, you don't even have to watch it all that closely. Whoever he talks to last, he will then quote them. Like when he had talked to the Big Lebowski after he talked to Walter, and he said, this is unchecked aggression, man. It's like, that would never have entered his consciousness if somebody hadn't said it. And then in the parlance of our times, after he talks to Maude, and every scene after
he
talks.
That's such a good point.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I hadn't thought
about
that.
And he always drinks his disgusting white Russians at any time of day, morning, noon, and night.
Yeah, and there's so many sites out there that track this movie in detail. We've seen it maybe 10 times. There are people who have seen it 100 times.
People are obsessed.
Apparently he drinks 9 white Russians. He apparently, you know, does all these other things that people keep track of, this intimate, you know, connection they have with every single action. And he deserves none of it. He's not this incredible character.
And would y'all, do you guys think that Jeff Bridges smoked weed while filming this?
Well, I don't think he needed to.
He
I have
didn't.
A feeling he's a good enough actor. Yeah, he probably wanted to be sharper than that.
Because people wanted to ask. Because, I mean, the dude is basically blazed the entire film. And in the behind the scenes, actually, Jeff Bridges said one of the ways they did it was they would just say, "Do we think he rolled a joint right before this or not?" And then he would just make his eyes red and start the scene. It's craziness.
Yeah, and I think the another thing they pointed out is he is in every scene. The Big Lebowski is in every scene.
You mean
scene.
The dude,
yes. Yes, the dude's in every scene. And they say even that scene when they're having the pancakes, there's some nihilist. Spoiler alert, there's some nihilist and they're eating at IHOP or Denny's or something. Yes. In the background, you can see a van and it's Walter and the dude are going by. So technically, they're in that scene too.
Oh, that's so funny.
That is funny.
That kind of attention to detail just makes the Coen Brothers films elite, because that's so good. Oh my gosh, that's funny.
That's amazing. And then one other character actor, Sam Elliott. Remember?
The narrator. I love their narrators, but this one really plays.
I know, this time,
role.
This is the first time the narrator actually comes out.
He's the best voice ever.
And is narrating while he's on the screen, as opposed to some of their other films where they have narrators and you don't hear about it. But remember the director's cut? They were showing that Sam Elliott would go to the director and producer, Joel and Ethan Coen, and say, "I'm enjoying myself, but why am I in this movie again?" He's real. He plays a cowboy. I mean, he's an old-fashioned cowboy.
And
right?
This movie's not a Western. And they actually said one of the reasons they really liked Sam Elliott, too, is because his mustache was so bushy that they could place words in his mouth that he wasn't saying at that time. So it, like, made vocal stuff really easy, which is just hilarious. But yeah, there is literally no reason he needs to be in the movie. It's just, it's ridiculous. It's amazing, though. I'm trying to think of my other favorite scenes. I mean, we got to talk about the whole Steve Buscemi thing.
Yes.
How a few movies ago he died and you see his body. I think it was Miller's Crossing.
Right.
And then in Fargo, he dies, but all you see is his knee. And now he's been whittled down to dying and just being ashes. So he just gets smaller and smaller every film. And that scene
is so funny. They're on a cliff. And yes, it's the worst, I guess, spreading of ashes you could ever imagine.
And worst eulogy ever.
Oh, that's terrible. And the coffee can.
Oh, my gosh.
So bad.
What a movie.
What about the toe scene?
Oh, my goodness.
When they're in the diner. Oh, I can get you a toe.
I can get you a toe. Oh, speaking of the toe scene, we got to talk about the special DVD edition.
Oh, yes. We'd had this DVD for many, many years. Maybe not quite 20, but definitely 10, 15 years. Maybe, I could have sworn we'd seen it before, but this time we just pushed play and It's like, who's that guy? It was some old man talking about the restoration of the Grand Lebowski. And at first, the first 30 seconds, you think it's legit, you know? And then, and I think even that's an inside joke, like making fun of, again, film restorations. It's great. And film restorers out there, they do a great job. But sometimes you can get so into a movie like, oh, and the arcane facts, the esoteric facts that for some reason, all the prints were destroyed of the film. But they found one, and this is, you know, they showed it, and it was Japanese, right? Yeah.
And then they're Italian, right?
Yeah, it was colored. They didn't have a color corrected version, except for one Italian version, right?
Yes.
And so all they had to do was bring back every single actor and redub all the entire movie, which is ridiculous.
Or that's the story that he was telling. Because he's this fictitious, film restorer.
And that's very similar to Fargo, how it starts with the. Everything in this is true. But yeah, the weird thing about this is that's not how The Big Lebowski normally starts. I think that must just be a DVD edition.
Yes, see, there's value to DVDs. Yeah. They're bringing the DVD back, baby.
It is pretty hilarious. So.
I just wonder if that was an original idea. I mean, I almost wonder if they thought about starting the movie that way originally and then just ended up cutting it or deciding not to include a scene like that at the beginning.
It is kind of the same. I mean, the reason we love their movies and their humor so much is because we have the similar kind of humor. Like, you know how we used to have the idea if we were ever famous singers, our first album would be like Livia Martinez's greatest hits. Yeah. Like, so like, that's like, that sounds like something the Coen brothers would do, just making fun of it all.
Yes.
But are there any other scenes you guys want to talk about? We're getting long here, but it is such a good movie.
Well, the part where his car is stolen and he asks the detective, are there any leads?
This is an LAPD guy.
Oh, wait, and the chief, the police chief in Malibu, who is just so tough.
He is like the toughest guy.
Yeah, stay out of my beachfront community. He throws that cup at him, and he's behind a desk. We've mentioned the desk a few times. There's a desk in every movie,
always.
Every Coen Brothers.
And the Big Lebowski's behind the desk.
Yes, like there's a clear authority on one side and a clear non-authority on the other side.
And we haven't even really talked about Larry Sanders, the kid. But
Larry Sellers.
Sellers.
Yes.
Oh, wait, Larry Sanders, who is that?
He was Gary Shandling on a TV show many years ago.
Very funny TV show.
Yeah, I knew that. But yeah, Larry Sellers, this random kid. Oh my gosh. And the fact that they just keep going back to, oh yeah, some kid has the $1 million. It's insane. But overall, great movie.
Yes, I know. Really, it's hard to beat this one. I mean, every single time we've watched it, we laugh. I mean, it's like we laugh at the scenes that we laughed at before, and then we laugh more at scenes that we'd kind of forgotten.
And also, really fast, the dude never bowls in this film.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
He
listens to bowling on his Walkman. He's got a Walkman, right?
Yeah, he listens to bowling sounds.
And then when he's not listening to whale sounds and smoking Thai stick.
That's certainly not listening to the Eagles.
No, he's not like the Eagles. It's just such a good movie. And wait, what's his name is in it too for a little bit?
Yeah, another regular Coen brothers, part of their ensemble is a gentleman named John Polito. He's in Miller's Crossing. He was in The Man Who Wasn't There. And he plays a detective here. And same character, kind of slimy. And he only has about 5 minutes too, but they're very memorable. It's crazy, you know.
Everyone in this does such a good job.
The other thing about The Big Lebowski, you know who they wanted to play?
Yeah. Who?
Marlon Brando.
Oh,
but he was not doing too well. He was ailing by that point.
He would have been so difficult.
Yes.
Oh, and what were you saying about The Big Lebowski and Citizen Kane?
I always wondered. It seemed like the house that The Big Lebowski lived in, it was ornate and it was this, you know, grand mansion and probably Beverly Hills or something. But it reminded me of like San Simeon in Northern California. So I almost wonder if there were some allusions to Citizen Kane.
I'm sure there were. But man, it's such a good movie. The plot makes no sense. If we'd be here all day if we were trying to describe the plot, so we don't even want to get into that. Should we get to ratings? Or is there any other stuff?
Yeah, the only other thing was Charlize Theron might have been Bunny, but it was instead it was Tara Reid, and even she was good in it.
Yeah,
again,
she
Tara
did a good
Reid
job.
Was perfectly fine as a starlet. Whatever.
Yeah, I don't think they needed Charlize for that.
No.
That would have been like,
That must have been before she was famous. She just was probably
definitely.
She would have fit the profile, actually.
Yeah, that would have been crazy.
Kind of blonde, pretty girl.
So, how many? I mean, I don't know, bowling balls or what else? It seems obvious, but I feel like that's the way to go.
Yes, bowling balls. It has to be
okay.
6 out of 5. How about that? It's one of my favorites. We'll get into the favorites at some point during this series, but it's at the top of my list. It's It was funny when we saw it. We saw it twice at the movies. We've probably seen it 10 to a dozen times since then, and it's always worth, it'll always make you laugh, as Em said. I mean, for one reason or another. And that's the true definition of our favorite movies, where you can see it again and again and again. It was great.
And you can't help but like the people in it. Again, it's like they're just some kind of despicable moments all of them have, and yet they're just all kind of lovable.
Except for the Big Lebowski. He's so annoying.
Yeah, he's pretty grumpy. And as far as my rating, I wish that we did have a scale of 1 to 10, because I would definitely have to give it an 11. Uh-huh. But yes, I'll give it a 5 without any question. It's a high 5.
High 5! I would also give the Big Lebowski a 5. So, I mean, I think that's about it. I take great comfort knowing that the dude is out there.
The dude abides.
The dude abides, man.
I love that. Speaking of the dude abides, I'm glad you said that, because go to our website, strangelovemovies.com. We have a lot of extras. You'll see photos of our visit to the Lebowski Bar in Reykjavik, Iceland.
I heard that they closed that down. Isn't that a shame?
Oh, well, even more exclusive then.
I know.
That's a shame.
It was so cool.
And also a little hidden gem. Nobody knows about this one. Y'all have probably forgotten, but when I was in Wisconsin for that training a few years ago, mm-hmm. Sounds suspicious, doesn't it? There was a apartment complex named after the dude, and you'll see a picture of it on our website.
What was it called?
The Dude Abodes.
That's so clever. That's so funny. Hopefully those people pay their rent on time. Follow us on Instagram at StrangeLoveOfMedia. And like Dad said, visit our website, StrangeLoveOfMovies.com. And next week is another classic. This is, I mean, possibly the three best films in a row, because we got Oh Brother, Where Art Thou coming, episode 8. So we will see you then. Bye.